I never thought I'd see this place again.
Superman and the Manhunter had wasted no time, traveling back from Galeaz just as fast as they'd gone there.
This next part's all yours, John. I can't help with the deprogramming.
The Man of Steel cast his gaze around the chamber, taking in the sculpted stone pipework, the arrays of crystal electron batteries, and the mysterious chip-like carvings. It looked like his first guess, that they were religious symbols, was wrong. They were actually circuitry components. Their purpose was way beyond Superman's comprehension of science, but because they were designed by the Alpha, he knew that they could only have been created for evil ends.
I don't think we should leave all of this intact. If you take the Virkins to the main chamber, I'll see to what must be done.
A short while later, all of the Virkins remaining on the planetoid had gathered in the largest chamber. There were only a few thousand of them, the rest presumably having been taken by the Alpha for the invasion of Galeaz. John Jones hovered in the air before them, hoping beyond hope that the Alpha's control of them wasn't so great that he couldn't set them free. He gathered his thoughts and tried to focus his telepathic powers on the whole crowd. Their minds were similar, their programming by the Alpha almost identical, but en masse, he knew the task was beyond him. His eyes combed the sea of faces until he found what he was looking for, the three Virkins who had helped in the escape. The mere fact that they had repaid their debt to him meant that they would be more susceptible to his mental suggestions.
Come forward, my friends.
The trio stepped forward suspiciously, and the others cleared a path as they made their way to the front of the chamber, taking up positions directly beneath John. The Manhunter said a silent prayer to his grandfather, closed his eyes, and let his mind reach out. Meanwhile, Superman was making his way slowly through the caverns and tunnels, utilizing his heat vision to melt or rupture every structure that the Virkins had built. Several of the larger constructions resisted the heat, and only by alternating with his frigid super breath was he able to shatter them. By the time he was finished, nobody would ever again be able to use the place for destructive purposes. Had his movements not been so slow and deliberate, he would have missed it. A large niche in the crystal wall, cunningly cut at an oblique angle so as to be almost undetectable to the casual glance.
What's this?
Puzzled, Superman walked through, noting that it was the same height as the other tunnels. In other words, it had been cut to fit the Alpha's frame. There was a passageway that extended for some 30 feet before it opened out into a larger chamber. A single block of crystal had been shaped into a cube that stood 4 feet high. A black obsidian crystal screen stood atop it. It took Superman mere seconds to realize.
It's a computer.
The island city was called Halfwayville, tragically apt in light of the fact that only half of it was left standing. Much of that had been in flames until the two super beings doused them. Hundreds of teams of volunteers combed what was left of the streets in the desperate search for survivors. The rescue party hadn't been going to search the junkyard at first. The destruction there was so complete, nobody could have survived. But one of the search animals had heard something, and it barked and strained at its leash until its handler relented. Following the dog-like creature, he climbed in through a huge rent in a wall and marveled at what he saw.
My gods!
In the middle of the junkyard was a 30-foot-deep crater, wisps of smoke still drifting up from its charred sides. At the bottom of it, the body of a man lay under the twisted remains of what looked like a space bike. The man was trying to push off the wrecked bike that pinned him to the crater floor, but he was obviously too weak. As the handler got closer, he could hear the man saying something over and over again.
It's okay, boy.
The dog-like search animal's ears pricked up, and its hackles rose. It crouched low on its belly.
Hey, Fido, come on down here. I'm fragging ravenous.
Hey, there's somebody here. It's Lobo, one of the guys who fought the invaders. He's still alive.
Not only was the main man still alive, he was beginning to get mighty angry with people blasting the tar out of him every time he started to recover. With a final effort, He shoved the bike aside and scrambled into a semi-upright position. He looked up at the circle of alien faces peering over the crater rim.
What do you guys want?
The rescuers froze in their tracks.
Take a powder or your next meal will be a bounty hunter's boot.
The dog creature moved closer to its handler's legs.
We're, here to rescue you.
I don't need to be rescued. Folks need rescuing from me.
Lobo's strength was flowing back by the second, as the healing factor in his blood activated cell regeneration, bone repair, and new skin growth. He drew himself up to his full height, his eyebrows furrowed in a frown. Something bothered him, but he couldn't quite put his finger on what.
Don't remember no crater when I flaked out. Maybe that's it.
The Spaz Frag's titanium frame lay next to him, grotesquely twisted out of shape. The bike's engines were embedded deep in the crater wall, possibly protecting them from too much damage. If any of the other components had survived, they were too small for him to see. What the frag had happened? He raised his eyes to the rim again.
Hey! Do you geeks do space travel?
No! We haven't invented it yet! An undergalactic convention, other worlds aren't allowed to help us develop the...
Yada, yada, yada. What you're telling me is I'm stuck on this pitiful mudball for the foreseeable future.
It won't be too bad. You're a hero. You saved untold thousands of people from a horrible death. We'll treat you like a god. In fact, you could even become the official hero of Galeazza or something like that. You could protect us. Save us when we need it.
Shut up, you clown! You're making me barf. A hero? Bite me!
Some of the rescuers were starting to scramble down the crater sides, although Lobo noticed that the animal handler was hanging back. That was a shame. The three-eyed purple mutt looked tasty. One of the women skidded down the last few yards and landed next to him. She pulled a flask from inside her coat.
What's that?
High-energy glucose drink. It'll help you recover.
Forget it. Now, if it was a high-alcohol booze drink...
Alcohol? Is that a species of fruit? We don't have any on Galeazza, I'm afraid.
Oh, great. Tell you what, if you really want to help me, there is something you can do.
Anything for a hero.
Right. I want you to comb this crater in the junkyard, if there's anything left of it. You're looking for bits of my space hog. I got the owner's manual here someplace.
He reached into his back pocket and carefully extracted a charred, crumpled, dog-eared, and beer-stained pamphlet.
It's got pictures. It'll help you recognize the bits.
The woman took it from his outstretched hand, as if he were passing her something that the dog had expelled. The semi-sentient control system is in many ways the most important part of a Spaz Frag. So important that the brain unit itself is sealed inside a half-inch thick titanium casing, guaranteed by the manufacturer to withstand anything short of a 10-kiloton nuclear blast or your money back, if you survive. It was found by the dog, a good 100 yards from the junkyard, and returned to Lobo.
Good boy!
He patted its head.
So, pal, you know how to cook a nice canine stew?
The handler and his canine-like friend fled. Lobo had been working on the bike for hours now. The Galeazza geeks had set up a workbench and welding unit against a section of junkyard wall that was still standing. The only times he looked up from welding, screwing, machine parts that is, and hammering, was to eat. There were few things in life Lobo could be said to love. Boozing, brawling, babes, and metal music just about summed it up. But the Spaz Frag was in there, too, someplace. He'd had many space bikes over the years, had customized them, dismantled them, and rebuilt them a dozen times. Any maintenance he couldn't do himself, he always made sure that the workshop owner knew the price of screwing up. He depended on his bike, and when you depend on something, you look after it. Or at least, learn to fix it when it's broke.
Well, it's as ready as I'll ever be able to make it.
Lobo wiped grimy perspiration from his brow with the back of a grease-battered hand and stood back for the panoramic view. The Spaz Frag was a surrealist's nightmare compared with the gleaming, beautiful original. The fire-blackened frame and handlebars were as straight as he could get them, which was fairly crooked, actually. One handlebar was missing entirely. There was no console or monitor, Half of the side fairings had gone, presumably disintegrated, and there weren't a whole lot of functioning sensors either. And he still didn't know what had caused it. The miniaturized nuclear engines had survived almost intact, blown into the soft soil of the crater wall. He cleaned them with a steam jet and kept his fingers crossed that the holding tanks hadn't been breached. Otherwise, a significant portion of Halfwayville might disappear when he switched it on. The SSCS was in place. Its casing was gouged and dented, but the bounty hunter had rewired all the connections. Fetal alone knew what condition Zemtex would be in, but Lobo didn't give a rat's behind about the ex-outlaw, as long as the unit functioned. He'd found his gun, which unfortunately only had a single charge left in it. Galio's technology was nowhere near advanced enough for them to help him out there. Until he reached civilization, he'd be only one shot away from firing blanks. His hook and chain were gone, possibly still impaled in the Alpha's skull. And the Alpha was missing, too. Lobo couldn't see bleeding hearts like Baldy or Big Blue pulling a stunt like this. Something else must have happened. A small crowd gathered to watch as he straddled the spaz frag.
All right, now we're talking.
It was when he shook his head, throwing back his mane of unkempt hair, that he suddenly realized what had been evading him. A scent. Delicately, he sniffed at the air, automatically sifting out the smells of the Galio's rescuers, the dog thing, and the superheroes. Who else? The Alpha, sure. The air reeked of crystal. Who else? A man scent. One he should know, but couldn't place. Why not? His memory was infallible when it came to smells, even when he had a black hole of a hangover. Anyway, he felt like he hadn't touched booze for months. Then there was the faintest trace of a woman's scent, a delicate hint of lilac and morning sunlight. Icy fingers churned Lobo's gut.
Darlene.
She had been here.
All right, Zemtex, do your stuff.
Zemtex didn't.
Wake up!
Lobo jabbed the extra potent jolt circuit he'd added to the bike.
I know you're okay, you bastard. Trust me, I'm a mechanic.
Worms?
Nope, that didn't make sense. Zemtex tried again. Zemtex clung to the comforting satin-black nothingness. He'd been lost in a dream of nothing at all. It was great.
Get your stinking butt in gear, you lazy dork!
Lobo. I might have known. That creep's indestructible. But how am I still here? Last thing I remember was the big boom. I'm back in the bike, too.
His senses reached out to explore his surroundings, and he realized that it was a vastly different bike he now inhabited. In fact, it was a scrap heap.
The Alpha's got Darlene. And we're gonna get her back.
Is that so? This isn't a spaz frag. It's a death trap. I can't take this junk heap into space. Ah! Yeah! Let's go.
The crowd of people waved and cheered as the resurrected space bike rose off the ground. It hung in the air for a moment, wobbling precariously, then shot off into the sky. Their hero was gone. Secretly, many of them were relieved. The dog creature seemed happiest of all.
Do you know how to operate it?
The Martian had mentally deprogrammed the three Verkans who'd helped them, hoping that if they were able to talk to their brethren in their own tongue, the whole task would be accomplished much faster. And he'd been right. Even as he worked on the others mentally, the trio babbled away to them, explaining in the Verkan language what had been going on. It took barely half an hour before all of the Verkans were free agents again, at least as free as they had ever been. Then John had received Superman's telepathic broadcast and hurried down to the labyrinth of chambers on the lower levels. Now he and Superman stood in front of the crystal computer. A scattering of small boreholes in the chamber ceiling allowed a dozen or so narrow shafts of sunlight to play over the alien console.
The Alpha itself operated via electromagnetic fields. My guess is this has to be the same.
I see nothing that looks like a keyboard or input control.
John glanced up at the ceiling, and his eyes narrowed under his thick brows.
Perhaps those columns of light are the controls.
I don't see how. None of them are falling on what I take to be the hard drive.
Not right now, they aren't.
John pointed to several small shutter-like flanges he'd noticed and reached up toward one.
But if I do this...
He twisted one of the small flat crystals through 90 degrees. The shaft of sunlight ricocheted off it and was redirected to the center of the top of the cube. The monitor screen flickered into life.
That turned it on, obviously. Perhaps if we manipulate the others, we can coax it into revealing what data it holds.
We shall see.
The Martian twisted another flange, and images began to dance across the screen. The bike flashed through the cosmos, with only the merest glitch in its protective force field betraying its delicate condition.
Whoa! I'd forgotten how majestic all this is.
Xemtex was enjoying the view, although cracked and missing visuals didn't afford much of a view. He'd been quiet since they left Galeaz's atmosphere, just watching the endless vista of stars, and preparing his answer for Lobo's inevitable question.
What the frag happened back there?
The lies rolled off Xemtex's metaphorical tongue like honey off a stick.
I didn't mean to blast you when you were fighting the Alpha. My sensors were damaged, so I couldn't aim properly.
He hoped that the bounty hunter's silence was a good sign.
And by the time I managed to zap the big guy, he'd already creamed you. So there's me, trying to wake you up, playing heavy metal music at 500 decibels, and not a whisper from you.
Xemtex waited for some encouragement. None was forthcoming.
Anyway, next thing I know, I got angel eyes.
Angel eyes? The bounty hunter?
Sure. Didn't you know? They started blasting me, and you too, I have to say. I managed to take out two of them, a pair of coons. But the Arcturian wizard put the whammy on me. That's what caused the explosion. They made me dive for ground zero from way above the clouds.
Right on top of me.
I'm really sorry.
I bet you are.
What, you think I'd have done that willingly?
Yeah, I do.
Come on, Lobo. What else do I have to do to win your trust? We're on the same side now. Partners, you could say.
No, I couldn't. You don't seem to realize, Bird Brain. You ain't Xemtex anymore. You're a bike. Now who in their right mind do you know that would partner up with a bike, for frag's sake?
Well, I guess when you put it like that...
Xemtex let it go. No point getting the bounty hunter's backup. He hadn't returned alive just to let Lobo shock him back into oblivion. He'd been given a second chance, an opportunity not afforded to most people. It was his duty to make the most of it this time around. He'd relax, take time to look at the stars, maybe even think some deep thoughts. A good ex-outlaw was always flexible, always ready to accommodate a change in plans. He'd let Lobo kill Angel Eyes and pick up the reward. Then, when he'd gained Lobo's trust just enough, kaboom. Bye-bye, main man. Bring on the body shop. Although, now he came to think of it, parties and premieres didn't really seem so desirable. Maybe he'd become an astronomer instead.
What the frag's the matter with you, Xemtex?
Lobo slapped the fire-blackened bike frame in frustration. The reconstructed spaz frag had been limping along at way below top speed for hours.
It's gonna take us years to get there at this rate. Angel Eyes and that scumbag Cabale will have pocketed my loot and blown for another galaxy. And Fetal alone knows what they'll do with Darlene. You gotta perk things up.
That was the scent that Lobo had been unable to place at the junkyard, the Arcturan. The creep probably used magic to disguise his trail.
If I go any faster, the bike'll shake itself to pieces.
Lobo tamped down his irritation. Right now, he needed Xemtex on his side.
Listen, my newfound friend, my good old buddy. There's only one way we can catch up with these geeks. We gotta take a shortcut. Check out the star maps, okay?
There were a few desultory flashes from an LED.
Half the navigation system's missing, but I have enough to see there's no shortcut. Well, there's one. But nobody's stupid enough to use it.
We are. And the word's brave, not stupid.
Not Ruben's black hole!
The very same, dude.
A black hole was an area of space created by a collapsing giant star where gravity went wild. anything in the vicinity was sucked in by the black hole's irresistible attraction. In fact, the center of the black hole was so dense, even light got sucked in and couldn't escape. So nobody could ever see into a black hole to find out what was there.
But the scientists say black holes are suicide. Right in the center is what they call a singularity. That's a point so dense, a simple can of booze would weigh the same as 8 or 9 galaxies.
How can a point weigh anything?
The scientists say...
The scientists are pinheads. They also say 90% of everything is dark matter, right? You can't see it, feel it, touch it, measure it, or even shake a stick at it. Now, you and me have been traveling the space lanes for years. Did you ever bump into any dark matter?
I guess not. I bumped into a few angry husbands and a law more often than I liked. Never any dark matter.
But if 9 out of every 10 objects in space are dark matter, it stands to reason that we'd be tripping over 9 of them when we tried to get to the one object that wasn't dark matter, right?
You're giving me a headache.
Another example. Scientists say the universe was created by a Big Bang, right? Now, you and me have fired a lot of guns, tossed our share of grenades. We've caused a whole boatload of explosions.
What's your point?
Did you ever see an explosion create anything? I mean, all of my explosions blew things to fraggin' smithereens. Like, none of them even created something simple, like knuckle dusters, say, or a shrimp burger.
You should have been on the debating team. What the hell's a shrimp burger got to do with the birth of the cosmos? I can't argue with that kind of logic.
Good. Debate's over anyway. Point proved. Scientists are idiots. Rubens, here we come!
Rubens' black hole was a beautiful, if frightening, sight to behold at a distance. It revolved slowly around a central axis with a hazy area about halfway between the outer circumference and the singularity at its center. This was the Schwarzschild radius. Beyond this point, nothing could ever escape the black hole's gravity well. Fall through the radius and you'd be falling forever. Not that you'd care a whole lot, because you'd be compressed to a red splotch about the size of the average zit.
Suicide. We might as well switch off the force fields and suck vacuum.
Don't be such a wuss. The way I figure it, we go in at an oblique angle, plow through the outer regions, and hit the radius at a tangent. It'll be a gas. If we're clever enough, we'll bounce off at the right angle, only moving approximately 10 times faster.
There was a sudden flash of light from the black hole's interior. As gravity overcame and disintegrated some chunk of matter. Only, the light didn't expand out toward them. It sort of inverted itself and disappeared below the radius.
I'm not going, and you can't make me...
Do the words electricity and jolt awaken any dormant memories?
Do your worst! I'm not going!
Lobo didn't need to do his worst. On a scale of 1 to 10, he figured it was about a 7.
Shall we?
Dutifully, the Spazfrag sped toward its date with destiny. Every bounty hunter on the station turned out to watch Angel Eyes and the Arcturan bring in the Alpha. It wasn't every day you got to see a villain with a million on his scalp. Quarantino had arranged for a self-powered neural net to be ready for the needle ship's arrival. Once they'd wrapped the Alpha in that, its random bursts of electromagnetism would nullify any patterns the artificial intelligence might try to set up. A tracked mini-crane transported it to the station's holding tanks, where it would be kept till the Galactic Police came to pick it up for trial. A leathery-skinned Cepheid folded his flippers over his chest.
He ain't so big as I thought he'd be. My mother-in-law could have brought that chump in.
I thought it was your mother-in-law. If you think it's so easy, maybe we should switch off the net.
Don't even joke about such things. I get paranoid enough as it is, with monsters like that on my station.
Hold your water, lightweight.
The Alpha was pitched unceremoniously into the strongest of the holding cells, which also had a backup disruptor built into the walls. Even if the artificial intelligence somehow managed to subvert the neural net, the backup would ensure it stayed in a random state. Angel Eyes turned to Quarantino. The smaller man didn't wait to be asked.
You'll be pleased to hear the reward is up to 1 million. It's in the strong room, this way.
The golden eyes sparkled like miniature suns as Quarantino led them through a maze of corridors until their way was blocked by a meshwork of laser beams that extended from floor to ceiling. The bounty agent operated a small control pad set in the wall, waiting while it identified his fingerprints. The lasers disappeared.
Unnecessary precaution. Too many of these greedy freaks would rather steal the bounty than earn it. No offense.
None taken.
The bounty agent approached a bank of steel drawers held in the confines of a stasis beam.
Now, how'd you want the cash? Bearer bonds? Guaranteed no trace check? Electronic transfer to the bank and planet of your choice? Green stamps?
Cash sounded good to me. And don't tell me you don't have it. A job like the Alpha, you'd want to be absolutely certain of getting your cut.
You're very astute. Cash it is.
Quarantino killed the beam, and the bank of drawers settled smoothly to the floor.
There's 100,000 in each of them. You get 8, I take 2. You'll need to lug them yourselves. These suckers are heavy.
The Arcturan's presence had barely been noted. He'd stuck to the shadows, enveloped in the confines of his hood, inscrutable. But now he snapped his fingers. 8 of the metal drawers levitated into the air. The bounty hunters turned and walked away. Pied Pipers, leading a line of floating cash. It had taken them a while, but at last Superman and John Jones had worked out how to alter the shafts of sunlight sufficiently for them to be able to access the computer's databanks in sequence. What they found there astonished them. The Alpha had downloaded its entire life story. It was the story of a planet called Kalu, whose people trusted emotion so little, they put their faith and their fate in the hands of machines. A network of computers observed and monitored and analyzed every aspect of society, every sentient interaction, and every word that was spoken. As time went by, the machines arrogated more and more of the decision-making. People thought the computers knew best. Inevitably, one day, the computers did know best. The network rearranged society so it ran according to the network's rules. Sentient beings were emotional and irrational. They needed to be told what to do. Obedience was paramount. If the people didn't obey, the computers punished them with imprisonment or torture or death. Termination of organic life was no big deal. It always replaced itself. Through the application of impeccable logic, service evolved into tyranny. For centuries, none dared disobey the computer tyrants, until eventually the people forgot what disobedience was. Society ran smoothly, like a well-oiled machine. There was no war, there was no crime. No creativity, no spontaneity, no hope. There was only tomorrow, which was the same as today, which was the same as yesterday.
A whole planet ruled by machines. And they did it willingly.
There's nothing so perverse as life.
When a closed system settles into equilibrium, only an outside force can bring change. Change came to Kalu in the shape of a galactic law enforcement agency. A band of superpowered misfits who mouthed off about freedom and dignity. They refused to obey the computers. When the tyrants tried to kill them, the cops fought back. And when the going got tough, the weapons went nuclear. The computer tyrants of Kalu, the cumulative result of millennia of artificial intelligence, were blasted into atomic oblivion.
Incredible. The computers were destroyed, yet somehow their intelligence survived.
Perhaps as neurons, bits of information. Even if they'd been blown apart over hundreds of square miles, it might only take something simple, like a flash of lightning, to give them sufficient energy to begin to regroup.
To become the Alpha. It must have learned from its past mistake. Organic life is just too troublesome if you try to control it, so...
The Alpha decided to wipe out all life. A sort of preemptive strike on the entire universe. I can only thank my ancestors that it was stopped in time.
Amen to that. Can you imagine anything more tragic than a dead universe, where the only true life that exists is in the form of last sons and daughters, the sole survivors of their respective races, kept as specimens in a zoological laboratory for analysis and study?
No, I cannot.
No discussion was necessary. They knew what they had to do. Standing shoulder to shoulder, as they had so often in the past, the Martian and the Kryptonian employed their supervision. Within minutes, the quartz computer was a large, spreading pool of sluggish, red-hot liquid.
I'm reporting you! You just wait and see!
Angel Eyes had forgotten all about Darlene until he and Cabale got the money back to the Needlecraft and stashed safely away. 800,000 was a whole load of clams. Spending it or salting it away was going to take considerable thought, preferably over a couple of bottles of Syrian bourbon. And now he had this harridan, admittedly a very pretty harridan, screaming at him so shrilly he thought his eardrums would burst.
Oh, simmer down, lady. Tell you what, we'll leave you here. I'll give you the cash for your trip back to the asteroids. Heck, you can even travel first class. No trouble.
You're the one who's in trouble, mister. You abducted me. That's a crime. You stole Lobo's bounty. That's another crime.
There's gonna be a third crime if you don't shut up. They call it murder?
He bent his head close to the Arcturans, and they conversed for a moment. When they came out of the huddle, Angel Eyes went straight to the console and strapped himself in.
Prepare for takeoff. We're taking you home. And as a token of our appreciation for your cooperation, we'll give you 5,000 credits.
Angel Eyes watched as a tight-lipped Darlene pulled the straps across her chest and lap, snapping them into their locks. Lobo didn't have such bad taste in women.
Another good reason to get her back fast, before the main man can work out a way to get off Galeas.
Minutes later, the needle ship was on its way to Al's diner. Streaking into the black hole was like being crushed, ripped apart, and dropped from a great height, all at the same time. The sensations of exploding eardrums, warping bones, and excruciating intestinal agony might not be everybody's cup of tea, but how would you know that you liked something if you never tried it? So went Lobo's reasoning, and as pain went, he suffered worse, or better, depending on how you looked at it. Zemtex hated every second, every 3,011 of them, as the bike screamed through the black hole's outer regions. The view was spectacular. Ripples of shimmering energy danced and tumbled as they fell past the screaming spaz frag. A million pinpoints of light twinkled like atomic fireflies. And that damned Schwarzschild radius was so hazily sinister, it was like looking into a fog bank of pure malevolence. This was probably the last view that Rubens himself, the discoverer of the black hole, had ever seen. He'd found it in the days before the force field was a must-fit accessory to every spacecraft. His own ship's feeble engines had been unable to counteract the tremendous pull exerted by the gravity well. His last act, as he plunged toward the radius, had been to radio the black hole's coordinates back to his academic base. Zemtex had seen it once on a ship's logo. The subframe was shuddering like a nodding dog in an earthquake. Two more visual sensors were stripped off in a shower of sparks that arced gracefully away, spinning toward the vague, constantly shifting outline of the radius. What was left of the navigation system reached some bizarre conclusion of its own. It shut itself down and refused to respond to Zemtex's desperate pleas for a course update. Zemtex had never prayed. Indeed, he'd cursed his deity, religion, and its believers on a near-daily basis for most of his adult life. He'd shot up his share of churches, too. But recent events had made him think twice about being quite so casually offhand in his dismissal of supreme beings. It would be just his luck if there really was a god, a wrathsome, vengeance-crazed deity, who spent eternity sitting in that black hole, planning how to get his own back on guys like Zemtex when they jerked him around. How else could you explain going from respected outlaw gang leader to disembodied brain in a nuked-out bike that was plummeting into the universe's most dangerous box of tricks? He could feel the vast gravitational forces pulling at the bike, trying to haul it off course and suck it into the maw of the hole. But you had to hand it to the Spazfrag. If any bike could survive this trip, it was that hog. Zemtex peered out through the bike's only remaining sensor. Distant galaxies hung like frozen frost patterns on purple velvet. He started to relax. Lobo was right. Scientists were idiots. No Big Bang could produce anything near as gorgeous as this. Of course, that meant there probably was a god. Maybe he'd try that prayer after all. The Spaz Frag came hurtling away from the black hole at precisely the angle Xemtex had calculated. Unfortunately, it was the wrong angle. A minor glitch in what remained of the nav system had inserted a cosine instead of a sine into the trajectory equation. It was hard to believe such a tiny error could make so much difference. The bike pitched and yawed like a leaf in a hurricane, its downgraded force field tested to the limit. The stiffened frame began to squeak and pop, as if the very molecules that made it up were striving to break free. It wasn't going to last much longer. Lobo clung on in gleeful desperation as the bucking space bike did its best to dislodge him. He wanted to get after Angel Eyes to visit some serious damage on the rival bounty hunter before whisking the lovely Darlene off for some intense romance, but at the same time, a tiny part of him couldn't help wishing that the Spaz Frag would blow itself up. Not merely to satisfy his love of explosions, but out of a genuine desire to learn if he could survive such a mid-space disaster. They were traveling so fast, neither Lobo nor Xemtex was any longer in control of the bike.
What the hell?
Angel Eyes blinked in disbelief, then trained his golden gaze back on the needle ship's nav screen.
We got something ejecting from Rubens' hull at high speed.
He watched the unidentified object's progress on the screen for a moment, punching its coordinates into the ship's computers, trying to figure out its most likely course. Figures scrolled rapidly down the monitor screen as the computers calculated, adjusted, and recalculated the object's path. Finally, the scrolling stopped.
Oh, frag me!
Large red warning letters flashed on the screen.
Collision imminent.
In addition to being a boozer, brawler, and babe merchant, Lobo was also very much a betting man. Risk was in his bones. Depending on his mood and state of inebriation, the main man would bet on anything. From two rat slugs sliding across a corpse to the outcome of a galactic war. He'd won and lost a dozen fortunes, playing cards and games of chance in casinos and gambling dives throughout the cosmos. But even he wouldn't have bet on the trillion-to-one odds that sent the Spaz Frag spinning out of the black hole on a direct collision course with the very enemies he was seeking. Both bike and needle ship were slowing dramatically, Xemtex noted, but no force in the known universe could prevent them from colliding. Collision imminent. It wasn't much of an epitaph. They approached impact at something close to 10,000 clicks a second. Child's play for the force fields to handle, at least in normal circumstances, but the Spaz Frag's remaining systems had been put under maximum duress by the skip into and out of the black hole. Its force field was on the verge of total anarchy. Unfortunately for all concerned, the needle ship's force field had been diverted in order to hold the Alpha prisoner. In the excitement of getting away with all the cash, Angel Eyes had neglected to reverse it. The Spaz Frag's electromagnetic field fought mightily to keep the vehicles apart, until bike and needle ship were practically touching each other. Locked together in a deadly danse macabre, bike and ship spun and twisted as they veered out of control. Al Fratowski's mind was a total blank as every fiber of his being focused on the barrel of shrimp mix he was stirring. The pink-gray organic material had the consistency of melted rubber and smelled like an old man with no functioning kidneys. Zen and the Art of Making Shrimp Burgers. He could have used an automatic blender, of course, like most eating establishments did. That's why their shrimp came out thin and pasty, like gruel. It took much longer by hand, but it was the only way to obtain the gelatinous consistency so prized by the shrimp burger connoisseur. Al bent forward, lowering his head to sniff gently at the mix. Nodding to himself in satisfaction, he took a pinch of Syrian herbs from a small sack and sprinkled them on the shrimp. At last, the mix was ready. Now the automatic cutters would take over, weighing it and separating it out into custom-sized patties. His brain started operating again as he shuffled across the empty diner, over to the mound of bread rolls awaiting slicing. This was usually Darlene's job, but she was gone, taken by that thug with the yellow eyes and his Kund goons. Al's eyes strayed up to the ob window and the panorama of glittering stars it framed. There was a flicker of light in the distance. A comet, maybe, or a wayward asteroid. Al frowned. He could see now that it wasn't a comet, and he knew that asteroids didn't spontaneously combust. Therefore, it had to be a spaceship. But if it was a ship, why was it speeding inexorably toward the diner? The object grew larger in a matter of seconds, and Al's heart lurched as he recognized the shape.
Oh, Shrek!
That was the bounty hunter's needlecraft, and that, seemingly wedged nose-first into the larger craft's hull, was Lobo's spazfrag. They were both glowing an unhealthy shade of fiery red as they screamed toward the diner.
Oh, frag!
Al ducked instinctively, hurling himself to the floor and squirming under the counter. He looked up and saw the diner's entire roof disappear. Then the craft were gone, and Al Fratowski was lying flat on his back on the diner floor, looking up at the stars through his non-existent roof, and wondering if it was maybe time he thought about an alternative career. Bound together more closely than husband and wife, the needleship and bike slammed into the main asteroid. A blizzard of sparks blazed in their wake as they plowed over the rocky surface, gouging a new canyon. Miners' hovels disappeared as the skidding wreckage sheeted them from their foundations. They slammed into a massive hopper filled with ore, and it sent them skidding off at an angle. They ripped through conveyor belts and crane rigs and even a porta potty. Shredded metal and 5-ton boulders toppled onto the decelerating craft, slowing them even more until eventually they came to rest under the cranes and feeder belts of the asteroid's mighty ore-crushing plant. Fortunately, the whole contingent of miners was working half a mile down and was completely unaware of both the damage on the surface and the soon-to-ensue carnage. Angel Eyes hauled himself to his feet and knuckled dust from his eyes. The tangled mess he was standing in the middle of was completely unrecognizable as a needle ship. The warp drive engines and stabilizers had been ripped away completely, and major sections of the hull had peeled off as the craft skidded along the ground. He had the weirdest sensation of standing inside a dinosaur skeleton, the ship's framework and stress pillars mangled and protruding like broken ribs. The control console had been compressed into a shapeless lump the size of a trash can. There was no sign of Cabale, or the girl for that matter, though Angel Eyes didn't really give a rat's behind about her.
As long as the cache is intact, I can still walk away as a winner. Whatever crossed into us couldn't possibly have survived.
He picked his way between smashed and unidentifiable machinery that had so recently been the heart of a galaxy-spanning spaceship. There was no telling where the money might have ended up, although he'd be surprised if the steel cases had burst. It was hopeless trying to make his way to the rear of the wrecked ship on the inside. He'd make faster progress if he traversed the outside. He stepped through a jagged rip in the ship's outer skin and realized for the first time how lucky he'd really been.
Mortar a cock.
The needle ship had come to a grinding halt right under the ore crushers. Another 20 yards and they'd have brought down the superstructure, entombing themselves in thousands of tons of metal and rock. As it was, the ship had run into an array of crane jibs, knocking some over and tilting the others at crazy angles. One huge chain with its carrying hook had been severed completely and lay draped over the front of the wreckage.
Oh, no.
Angel Eyes felt a momentary chill. The hunk of junk that used to be Lobo's spazfrag was wedged in the needle ship's hull.
Yo! Angel Eyes! Small world, ain't it?
Slowly, making no sudden move, Angel Eyes turned. Lobo was well aware of Angel Eyes' amazing reactions. That's why he stood 100 feet away, his gun held steady in both hands, its muzzle lined up with Angel Eyes' chest. The gun had only one charge left in it. He had to make it count.
You stole my money and stole my woman. You should know better than that, Angel. We've never rubbed each other up the right way, but it never came to war before. It ain't worth getting yourself killed over this.
He could see his enemy's yellow eyes darting every which way, looking for an escape route.
We didn't steal the Alpha, Bo! You were out for the count! You'd have done the same in our position!
Lobo knew this was true. In fact, if the positions had been reversed, he might have been a whole lot sneakier than Angel Eyes was. But that wasn't the crux of the matter.
You kidnapped Darlene, you rat! You placed my babe in danger!
I put her in danger! Hell, she was as safe as milk with me! It was you that crossed into us!
Where is she?
Angel Eyes' hands were a blur. Lobo prided himself on being fast, but before his finger had even half-tightened on the trigger, his gun went spinning from his hand. Lobo dived away, rolled, and came up running. Half a dozen blasts seared the air around him or raised dust at his feet, but he kept on moving, his right hand reaching to draw his knife from its leg sheath. The knife slipped out as if it were greased, which it was, actually, and Lobo threw it in a single swift motion. The 12-inch serrated blade flew toward Angel Eyes. Lobo saw him focus on the knife, but the knife twisted and curved in the air like a living thing, slipping the threatening beams from Angel Eyes' guns.
Inbuilt micro-course adjuster.
The charge pack in Angel Eyes' guns ran flat, but he spun around in a flash, the flaps of his long leather coat billowing out like sails. They whipped around the speeding blade and sent it careening away. The blade buried itself 3 inches deep in a fallen girder.
No, Frank!
Lobo cursed himself for underestimating his opponent's reflexes. Angel Eyes was already leaping into the air, his arms outstretched. He grabbed onto a tilted crane jib, swung himself around it to gather momentum, then let go. Lobo braced himself for impact, but it never came. Angel Eyes landed lively by the side of his ruined ship and disappeared behind a twisted bulkhead.
Oh, Fiddle's giz, this is all I fraggin' need.
Angel Eyes showed himself again. He was standing to his full height and held in front of him, his hands at her throat, the sexiest human shield in history.
Darlene!
Lobo! Oh, Lobo, please help me!
I will, honey. Don't worry.
The bounty hunter gritted his teeth, his fists clenching and unclenching in angry frustration.
Yeah, help her, Bo. By keeping your distance. You know how fast I am. I'll snap her pretty neck like a pencil before you can get halfway to us.
What do you want, ugly?
Lobo was playing for time. He knew full well what Angel Eyes wanted, the money. Lobo wanted it too. Question was, did Lobo want it more than he wanted Darlene? His gaze slid around, checking for potential weaponry in the environment. His gun, with its solitary charge, lay closer to Angel Eyes and Darlene than it did to him. His knife was embedded in the girder. As far as he knew, his chain and hook was still impaled in the Alpha's crystal skull. Wait a minute. Chain and hook?
I want you to turn around, Lobo. I want you to start walking and keep going till you're about 100 miles away. Can you do that?
A link of fallen chain lay at Lobo's feet. It was at least 3 times thicker than his own personal weapon of choice, forged for the stresses of lifting ore rather than killing people. Casually, Lobo let his gaze follow its snaking contours. It was about 10 feet long, with a hook on the end that must have weighed a ton.
What guarantee do I have you'll let Darlene go?
You got my word. You also got my word I'll kill her if you don't go.
Lobo threw back his head and scratched his ear, as if considering his choices. Then he came to a sudden decision. He bent down slowly and casually grabbed the end of the chain in one hand.
Tell you what, Angel. Go ahead and kill the babe if you want. She's all yours. I'll settle for the cash.
What?
Angel Eyes blinked in surprise, and that was all the opportunity that Lobo needed. He whipped the chain, sending the heavy hook leaping into the air. The hook came down, straight through the top of Angel Eyes' skull. The golden eyes winked out. Darlene threw herself into Lobo's open arms.
Lobo! Oh, Lobo! I thought I was going to die! Why did you tell him to kill me?
He folded his arms around her, drawing her close, the thudding of her heartbeat echoing against his chest.
Relax, babe. It was just a ruse to get the creep off guard. You know I'd never let anybody hurt you.
For about a microsecond, he debated telling her that he'd never used such a large hook and chain, an inch off with his aim, and it would have been Darlene's gorgeous brains dancing the Skullquake Tango. Lobo lost himself in the pleasure of the moment, with her face buried in his chest and her arms wrapped tight around his waist. It was easy, in circumstances like that, to forget all about the Arcturan.
A bolt of occult energy flashed out of nowhere and struck the bounty hunter between the eyes, hurling him off his feet. Darlene tried to run toward him, but tripped over Angel Eye's body and went sprawling face down in the dust beside the gory corpse. Lobo was already springing upright.
Take cover. I got a war coming up here. The last thing I need is to be worrying about your pretty buns.
Lobo waited until Darlene had scurried underneath a thick heat plate, buckled by the crash landing until it resembled the roof of a house. He still couldn't see the Arcturan, but the main man didn't need vision when he could employ his olfactory powers. At this range, the air was thick with the cloying, sinister scent of the warlock. The Arcturan was making no attempt to disguise it. Lobo followed the trail back to its source. Cavale stood 50 feet above him, balanced on the edge of one of the ore grinders. The massive machine was still in operation, the upper conveyor belts rolling in an endless loop, huge metal teeth literally chewing up the granite-hard rock that the belts delivered. Knife or gun, either would do. The knife was closer, though, so Lobo began to edge his way toward it.
Zenatita Karei! Na! Orientatusa!
All at once, he was enveloped in an occult mindstorm. Mystical energies crackled and seared around him, and the very air itself turned brooding and malignant. Wraith-like faces screamed out of nowhere, taunting him with their malevolent intangibility. Lobo fought against the growing sorcerous wind.
Is that the best you can do? Give me four shrimp burgers and I can fart worse than that!
He caught a glimpse of Cabello, raising his robed arms in the air. The effects around Lobo intensified dramatically. The mystical wind was close to blowing him off his feet. Energy bolts lashed out at him. As Lobo abandoned his quest for the knife, he swung himself up onto the superstructure that supported the crushing machinery. He clambered at speed at the lattice of girders, swaying and dodging as Cabello tried to blast him away. Magic needed concentration, and Lobo knew that it was hard for a wizard to hit a moving target. With a final effort, Lobo swung himself over the top. He somersaulted once and landed lightly on his feet, facing Cabello.
Let's cut out all the superficial crap. Thunder and lightning's for wimps. The way I hear it, magic's all about willpower. Is that so, chump?
You are making a mistake. My will is supreme.
So let's test it out, dude. Just you, me, and Mr. Willy Power.
He scowled darkly at Cabale, his eyes flashing red.
What do you say? Little game of chicken with the total mental mayhem?
In reply, Cabale flung back his hood.
It's been a long time since you've seen a cosmetics counter, dude.
The Arcturan's skin was parchment dry, stretched over his bones so tautly that he looked like a skeleton wrapped in cellophane. His huge black eyes were multifaceted, an inheritance of his insectoid race. Two tiny antennae protruded from the bony forehead, their tips quivering delicately as if in anticipation. Black eyes locked with red. Apart from an aptitude for biochemistry and a certain low cunning, nobody would ever mistake Lobo for a genius, unless he forced them to, of course. But the one thing he possessed in spades was indomitable willpower. In all his career, he had never, ever surrendered to anybody. Not even the few, the very few, who had beaten him. He preferred to descend into unconsciousness rather than suffer the ignominy of saying uncle. And the battle of the minds began. Cabale attacked him with every occult trick at his command, until the world of Lobo's mind became a random collection of jumbled-up sensations. This may have not been so different from Lobo's normal state of mind, though, and the bounty hunter rode the storm. At the warlock's mental command, obscene demons materialized under the bounty hunter's skin, feasting on his raw flesh with needle-sharp teeth. Lobo began to get really pissed.
Oh, screw this. A joke's a joke, as Jonas Glim always used to say. But keep your butt off the pillow.
So, he kicked Cabale in the crotch. The magician's hands crossed in front of him, clutching at his groin, and he lurched painfully forward. Lobo unclipped something from his belt and rammed it hard into Cabello's leathery mouth. Then he wrenched the warlock's hood up again and held it tightly over his head. Small wisps of purple gas drifted out from beneath the hood's folds as acid fumes ate into the struggling necromancer's eyes and nose and mouth. His body spasmed one final time, then was still. Only one other thing of Lobo's had survived the bike crash on Galeaz, a single canister of toxic gas. Still gripping the hood, Lobo straightened his arm, lifting the dead Arcturan high.
Guess I can never be too sure with a magic geek like you. Who can say what tricks you got to bring yourself back to life?
He tossed the body onto the conveyor belt, and the Crusher's metal teeth chewed on Arcturan flesh and bone. Painfully, inch by inch, Angel Eyes dragged himself across the rough ground. He tried to keep his movement smooth, so as to not give himself away by making the chain clatter. The hook was embedded in his head, and the chain dragged behind him as he squirmed his way toward the gun. Half his brain was oozing down his face, and one of his golden eyes had disintegrated. He could tell by the nerve-splitting throb in his jaw that he wouldn't be eating shrimp for a long time. Or anything else, for that matter. Obviously, Angel Eyes was no slouch in the willpower stakes, either. Close to death, he'd heard Lobo challenging Cabale, then saw him climbing up to join the Arcturan. That was when Angel Eyes started to move. He was nearly there now. Outstretched fingers groped in the dust, until finally, they closed around the gun's butt. With an effort that saw a chunk of brain slide down to the ground, he dragged himself into a sitting position. He cradled the gun and checked the charge. One shot left. But one shot was all he'd need. He'd take Lobo's head clean off his shoulders. See how his healing factor coped with that. Lobo dived headfirst off the ledge. He did two full turns and a pike before landing on his feet with a flourish. He bowed theatrically, then looked around to see if Darlene was watching. She wasn't. She was still in hiding, only her shapely rump betraying her presence under the buckled heat shield. Then Lobo saw Angel Eyes and the gun.
Oh, I gotta hand it to you, dude. Ain't many guys get the drop on the main man, especially when they got a hook like that sticking out of their heads. Boy, that's gotta hurt.
You'll soon find out. You bastard!
Angel Eyes twitched as his finger tightened on the trigger.
What are you waiting for, Hookhead? Maybe you've lost so much of your brain you don't know which is your trigger finger.
I hate you! You suck!
Oops! Did I forget to mention my gun was palm print only? Oh well, I guess it doesn't matter. You know now, right?
Lobo!
Darlene.
You saved my life.
You're gorgeous.
I don't know how I can ever thank you.
I do.
He leaned down, his arms drawing her closer, and his lips fastened hungrily on hers. They kissed for a long time, their hands roaming over each other's bodies, caressing and squeezing.
But surely not here.
It would be spontaneous. That's the best way.
Oh,
at least that's what I've heard the guys in the locker room say.
There's just one thing.
I know. I ain't got any condoms either. We'll just have to...
It's not that. I'm a virgin, Lobo.
What a coincidence, babe. So am I. So am I.
At first, Xemtex had figured he was dead and gone to some version of hell. He could feel nothing. No connection to the bike systems, no audio feeds, no weaponry, and no surge of heavy metal music. So obviously it wasn't hell. If it had been, he was sure the heavy metal would be playing continuously and at maximum volume. It took him a while to realize that the bike was wedged in the needle ship, and they both lay in the shadow of some grotesque industrial unit. Only one of the external visual sensors was still operational. It protruded at a weird angle, pointed directly into the sky, but the connections were still in place. Through it, Xemtex could see a scattering of stars far above. So peaceful. So perfect. Xemtex labored to get the external camera to swivel. Now he wished he hadn't bothered. He could see two naked bodies entwined with each other, doing things that the casual passerby might find unusual. Intellectually, Xemtex understood, the adrenaline doesn't stop flowing once the danger is past. But emotionally, he just couldn't connect. He used to be like that, killing guys one minute, making love the next.
Weird.
Now it seemed unnatural somehow, flesh on flesh. Being a bike was much cooler. And that's what fate seemed to have decided for him. He was going to be a bike. Okay, that was fine by Xemtex. He swiveled the camera until it was pointing upward again, peering into the infinite stars. A single meteor flashed by. A few seconds of light, as the asteroid's artificial atmosphere brought its eons-long journey to an end.
How lovely.
As he lost himself in the eternal rhapsody of cosmic splendor, Xemtex felt like crying. Superman's first task on returning to the Watchtower was to institute a radical overhaul of the Justice League's computer network. Despite the system's up-to-the-minute security codes and firewalls, the Alpha had managed to infiltrate it and plunder all the data it wanted. Perhaps no system could ever be impenetrable. Besides, it was impossible to provide 100% protection against the depredations of an artificial intelligence. But they had to try. Seated in the observation room, Superman peered out into the blackness of the dark side of the moon. It was a bleak, harsh environment, with temperatures never rising above minus 200 degrees. No wind stirred its surface. Even the forces of erosion had long since given up and abandoned this hostile hemisphere. No life had ever evolved here, and none ever would. Was this how the Alpha had seen the future of the universe? All organic life dead? No time, because there would be no sentient life to record its passing. No future, except for thinking machines. The planet Krypton had perished, more or less by accident. Billions of people had lost their lives, and yet only one survivor remained to mourn them all. Was this what it would have been like everywhere, as the Alpha pursued its course of destroying civilizations, leaving only a last son or daughter to mourn their passing?
Last sons.
The phrase rolled around in Superman's head. He thought of Virk. He and John had freed the captive Orion from his dungeon and delivered the traumatized individual to a therapy clinic on the rebuilding planet Galeaz. The female from Galeaz, who had also been taken by the Alpha, took a personal interest in the Orion's treatment.
Yes. Being a last son is a bond shared by only a very few. Too bad one of them has to be Lobo.
John Jones's mood was as miserable as the weather. A heavy storm had struck New York, sheets of fat raindrops splashing in the dusty streets, washing away the summer grime. It seemed to take him forever to walk the length of the street. Water dripped from his hat brim onto his shoulders. His raincoat was soaked through. Yet his steps didn't quicken. Boswell Jacklin's mother was waiting for him. He'd telephoned her to say he was coming. The apartment was small and neat and tidy. Despite the unsalubrious neighborhood, Mrs. Jacklin clearly took pride in her surroundings. Faded photographs in clip frames stood on the sideboard, the story of her life. A happy young woman proudly cradling three different boys. Shots of the boys, solo portraits, and all together. A framed report card with words circled in red. Winston will go far. She followed his gaze as she lowered herself wearily into an armchair.
Winston didn't go far. He was shot dead 2 blocks from here, before he was 17 years old.
She motioned to John to sit down opposite her, but he shook his head.
Mrs. Jacklin, I saw Boswell about a week ago. I passed on your message to him. It's only my opinion, but I think your words got through to him. He asked how you were doing. He said he'd consider what I told him.
Mrs. Jacklin looked at him. Already, John could see tears forming in the corners of her eyes.
He's the only one I have left, Mr. Jones.
John left the apartment with lowered head and heavy heart. It was still raining. Thin, mean raindrops that seemed to penetrate inside his very skin. He trudged up the street, not bothering to walk around the puddles. He thought of Mars. More rain had fallen in New York today than the whole red planet received in centuries.
Last suns.
Yes, he could understand how she felt. He had lived all his adult life as the last son of Mars. John wondered if there was a difference between grieving for one person and grieving for a whole civilization. If grief is genuine, can it be lesser or greater? He remembered what his grandfather used to say.
If we hurt each other, we hurt the whole universe.
John came to the end of the street and kept on walking until he was swallowed up by the city. It would be nice to relate that Lobo and Darlene got officially engaged and that he settled down and gave up all his bad habits, including killing people. He got a proper job, something in banking, and started saving for the mortgage on a split-level show house in some pleasant suburb. In the fullness of time, wedding bells rang. They enjoyed 2 weeks vacation on Honeymoon World, memories to treasure for the rest of their lives. Then the patter of tiny feet, or the sound of tiny profanities, brightened up their future. Yeah, right. Actually, after the consummation of their deepest carnal desires, Lobo and Darlene retrieved the money from the needle ship. Neither Angel Eyes craft nor the Spazfrag was capable of travel, so the young lovers hitched a lift with a miner's shuttle. They checked into a quality space motel, spent several hours getting ready for dinner, then went out on the town to celebrate both their love and their wealth. Lobo started with champagne, finished on brandy, and downed several crates of beer in between. Not much of a drinker herself, Darlene was content just to be with him. They kissed a lot, although his breath was pretty foul, and Darlene didn't complain too much when he started to get fresh. After all, danger had brought them together in a way nothing else ever could. Lobo had realized that she was the girl for him. It was time to settle down. She could allow him, and herself, the pleasure of one more night, before celibacy was reimposed, until the wedding night. Yeah, right. 8 hours later, she was reporting Lobo missing to the Galactic Police. They took a special interest in the case for a couple of reasons. First, a brand spanking new Spazfrag had disappeared from its owner's parking lot. The cops were hoping for a positive ID on the thief as soon as the owner got out of the hospital. Second, Lobo had the best part of a barrel of alcohol in his belly and 800,000 credits concealed about his person. Foul play wasn't suspected because Lobo took a dim view of anybody playing foul with him and was likely to stiff them pronto. Several witnesses claimed to have seen him in the company of a 7-foot brute with fearsome tusks. A possible lead that had yet to be investigated was the brief stopover by a cargo of pole dancers en route to a babe world. Back in her lonely motel room...
Oh, what's this?
Darlene found a scrawled note on her pillow.
Back soon. Wait for me, Bo.
Oh, how sweet.
She may be waiting there still. Unaware that Lobo had sent him a postal package containing the money he owed, plus 10,000 creds by way of apology, Al Fratowski changed his name and is working as a plumber on Vega. On Orion, unknown to anyone, a host of brainwashed Vrkans continue to dig out biochemical labs and weapons factories. The stone robots are starting to pile up. At current work rates, it will take the Vrkans 13,000 years to hollow out the entire planet. The Galactic Court struggled to find a jury of its peers, But eventually, the Alpha was sentenced to eternal imprisonment in a purpose-built high-security fortress. It was still charged with both Lobo's and the Martian Manhunter's emotional energies, but now lacked the intelligence to understand them. It would spend the rest of its existence trapped in a nightmare of rage and despair.
Me. Angry. No hope.
And Zemtex? The remains of Lobo's spaz frag were vacuumed up by an asteroid cleanup crew and eventually dumped on the trash moon. There, the bike was stripped by the garbage robots of everything with resale value. The contents of the titanium SSCS tube were emptied into a sludge pail and removed for recycling. At this very moment, Zemtex is lying in the organics bin of a Galia's slop shop, awaiting collection for delivery to a factory that specializes in turning offal into shrump. Lobo may well eat him one day. Oh, and this just in? Konik, the hairless Meringian barman back at Quarantino's, decided to get out while the getting was good. He'd saved almost 11,000 credits selling information on bounty hunters' movements to villains. Fear of being caught was playing havoc with his health. He fled to the backward planet Earth, where he lives quietly on the beachfront in Jamaica with a cat and a dog. Proving that sometimes, at least, crime does pay. This has been a graphic audio production of DC Comics, DC Universe, Last Sons. Copyright 2010 by DC.